Innovate is a word that is commonly used by advertisers. As defined by Merriam-Webster, it means to do something in a new way. Advertisers may say they want to innovate, but they often get nervous when it comes to execution. It's not easy to convince decision makers to try something new, but it's critical in a world where consumer behaviors can shift daily. Media and marketing campaigns that lack innovative strategy can quickly grow stale and reflect a subpar way of reaching audiences. Hey everyone, I'm Noor Nasir, Senior Director of Media Innovations and Technology at Centro and host of AdTech Unfiltered. This episode about the importance of innovation is titled Innovate or Die. Our guest, Chief Growth Officer of Publicis Group, Rashad Tabakawala, technically didn't say those exact words, but if you take a listen, you might agree that in summation, he does. Rashad is well-versed in knowing what it takes to wow clients and drive them into the future. With a near four-decade career at Publicis Group, he's led advertising and marketing teams for many of the world's most popular brands, including McDonald's, United Airlines, Procter & Gamble, and GM. Time magazine dubbed him one of five noted marketing innovators, and he was one of the first marketers to be inducted into the Ad Age Interactive Hall of Fame. This truly unfiltered episode on innovation with Rashad Tabakawala starts right now. Rashad, first I want to thank you for joining us here at Centro headquarters for an episode of Ad Tech Unfiltered. I am mostly operating under the assumption that many or most people who work in the Chicago media and advertising scene are probably pretty familiar with who you are and why you have influence in the industry. But for those who may be less familiar, can you give us some background on who you are and what you do?
Sure. Perfect. So I'm Rashad Tabakawala, and I am currently the Chief Growth Officer and part of the management team at Publicis Group. Publicis Group is a global firm focusing on helping our clients transform both their marketing as well as their business. It's about 80,000 people, as well known for its brands, Leo Burnett, Starcom, Digitas, Zenith, Sapient, and assuming it closes, Epsilon, Saatchi & Saatchi, etc.
Yeah.
And I've been there for 37 years, and I've worked across account service, media, digital, and corporate, and I've done both staff roles and operating roles.
What is your specific role at Publicis right now?
So my specific role right now, because it's late in my career, is a combination of three different things. The first one is providing a perspective to both our management and our clients on where the world is going and how to prepare for it. So sort of a futurist, thought leader, understanding trends. The second one is to talk a little bit about how all, both clients as well as our internal teams, can adapt to and remain relevant in transformative times, which is a combination of how do you grow and how do you lead, if
sure.
That makes sense. And the third is I am a person who is one of the folks who sort of is a face among many faces of the company at public events and, you know, conferences, both client as well as public.
Do you find that most holding companies and really larger agencies at this point have somebody in that kind of role so that there is a spokesperson that is that futurist or thought leader?
I mean, there are many companies that have folks like that. And remember, our company has not given me either the title of thought leader or futurist. Sometimes people who are considered to be futurists and thought leaders are not seen by anybody but themselves as futurists and thought leaders. It's more because I've been around for a long time and more of what I have sort of forecasted has come true than has not. So there's a bit of a track record. So people say, hey, we should pay attention.
Well, it's definitely a cool position to be in, even if it's an unofficial title. Like you mentioned, you've had a longstanding career. You've been with Publicis for 37 years. So I would like to take a little bit of time to recap on some of those particular things you've done along the way. How did you get started? How did you even get into it? Because I saw that your academic background was in finance and some other things that aren't really advertising specific.
Yeah. So I grew up in India. My undergraduate degree is in advanced mathematics. From the University of Bombay. I came to the University of Chicago for an MBA in marketing and finance. And at that particular stage, when I came out of school, which was 1982, the total number of people who were either of color, foreign, or women in business school was probably less than 15 to 20%. Definitely people who were of color or foreign was in the single digits, if that.
Wow.
And so it wasn't really set up to help us find jobs, especially for people who did not have green cards. That has changed this year from the University of Chicago. I was one of two Indians that graduated that year, and this year there'll be 50. So it shows you how far it's gone.
Yeah.
But lo and behold, I got exactly one job offer. And that job offer, I thought, I'm going to work for this company for 2-3 years, get myself a green card, and then go get myself another job. So that was the Leo Burnett company. And 37 years later, I'm still in the Leo Burnett building, which means I'm unemployable.
I don't know about that. I think, if anything, I'm feeling the opposite. So to build off of that, because I do have so many questions I want to ask you about, and really, I was really struggling to come up with what is the theme of today, because even if it might be a little much to say you can talk about absolutely everything, you can talk about almost everything. So with that in mind, I wanted the focus to really be on developing insights in the advertising world, or how to be an insightful advertiser. So an interesting note I want to bring up is that just yesterday, the manager who oversees my team, I work on a team called Media Innovations and Technology, he received a brainstorming note for a panel that he's going to be on. So one of the other panelists sent him these notes that specifically were suggesting what clients are distinctly looking for from advertising services, whether that be agency or agency-like entities. What I wanted to do is take a little bit of time and really see first, just get your confirmation that you might have said some of these things.
Perfect.
And even if you didn't say these things, maybe you can let me know how much you think they fall and qualify on the Rashad the Meter. So the first thing was that clients, as it relates to what they're looking for from agencies, the number one thing they're paying for is insights. They're looking for that opportunity to glean research and to really gather information on cultural, consumer, and contextual truths. First and foremost, does that sound about right as far as the primary thing they're looking for?
I would say it definitely is among the primary things. It depends on when I said such a thing. So it would be one of my top three. It may not be number one anymore because times change, but it's definitely one of the top three. So therefore, yes, it ranks high. And the reason people are looking for insights is they're really looking for insights about people and their business, because marketers are very smart about their particular industry. What agencies can do is we can look across industries and we don't live inside the client. So we can bring the voice of the people, the voice of the citizen, the voice of the consumer.
A second thing also related to that, and really related in so many ways, is that clients are looking for inspiration, and that inspiration is oftentimes also led from a desire for provocation or to be provoked.
Yes. So one of the key things is clients do look for ways to think outside what they currently think and how they can get inspired to change. And it's very easy to basically go in and say, only companies that are digital can move into the future, or you are doomed. But the ability to show examples of how companies of any size and any type reinvent themselves, and therefore they can recognize in that, even though it's a different industry, they can recognize they can do it too. So if you look at everything from, sometime people said no one can take on Netflix. I have a feeling that in a year or two, people will say, why didn't we see how strong Disney was going to be in this space?
Sure.
Or pizza is pizza. Well, if pizza is pizza, why is it that over the last 10 years, with the exception of Netflix as a stock, when you look at Facebook, Amazon, or Google, the best place to have invested was in Domino's Pizza.
Yeah.
Right? So Domino's rethought about pizza. Or let's see about how strong companies like Walmart are reinventing themselves to take on Amazon. And so a lot of it is inspiring people by not only showing them an outside perspective, but showing them an outside perspective with people and industry setups that are somewhat similar to theirs. Because when you show them only something that requires them to either leave their company or start with a complete blank sheet of paper, they don't get inspired, they get irritated.
Really correlating with that concept of inspiration is that clients are looking for ideas. How often are really agencies or agency-like entities really providing creative and original ideas these days?
Well, when we do them very well, and we're supposed to do those. And that happens to be a big part of our business. And increasingly what tends to happen is the ideas. In the old days, the ideas used to be big business building ideas. And for some time, we suddenly ended up being ideas about commercials or ideas about improving product. You know, there's a very interesting thing that the early days of Leo Burnett, we only had about 30 clients, and we operated out of only one place in the United States, Chicago. We were good enough that we actually as much pitched our clients as our clients pitched us. And why? Because we had given our clients ideas to build businesses. So it's not popular anymore these days, but still one of the most amazing brands ever built was Marlboro. When you think about everything from Tony the Tiger to Fly the Friendly Skies to generally thinking about different ways of positioning even ketchup, right? So we had business ideas. We had new product ideas. We were creating new categories. And now we have to go back to building business ideas. And so ideas can come from anywhere, but ideas, we should not be limited to having ideas just about communication.
So to that point, I am curious. So often now, I think the client side themselves or the marketer, they've taken that upon their own shoulders. And now I feel like they oftentimes have a differing expectation for what the agency is doing. Do you feel that that is the case, or do you feel there's a mixture of circumstances?
So, you know, to a great extent, the big thing that has happened is over time, as the world has become fragmented, it varies from client to client. But at times, agencies might have become limited in what they do. On the other hand, I can show you examples where they have actually expanded in what they do, but it all sort of varies. The word that I would today say, besides ideas and insights and inspiration, which I all completely agree with, is something else, which are all emotional. So what happens is those are somewhat rational. The emotional ones are the following. Who do I trust to take me into the future? So there they're basically asking, how can you make sure that I as a client am relevant, my business is relevant, and how am I sure that you are relevant? Yeah. Are you bringing modern skill sets, or are you selling me old skill sets? Are you solving my problems, or are you solving your problems? And then saying that because you solved your problems, you solved mine. So what is starting to happen because the world has changed, our clients are struggling not only with growth, but they're struggling with how to remain relevant. And at some particular stage, if you go solving a business problem, understanding with empathy what they have, but then you can also, through a combination of what you do and how you do it, gain their trust that you can take them. Because, you know, when you're going into the future, the path isn't really clear. But if you were going to go to an unknown place, you'd go with someone you trust, who you think has many skills, versus someone you aren't completely certain you trust, who has two skills. Because what if someone needs more skills than that? And that's one of the key things that's basically happened, which is why many of our companies, meaning across the industry, are slowly reinventing themselves around broader themes and bringing a suite of services to help our clients. And the other thing besides who do I trust to keep me relevant, a big part they're also looking for is another emotional thing, which is, are you good at collaborating? Because while all of us are adding more capabilities, our clients may not necessarily require all capabilities from one place. And the ability to mix and match is, again, something that where if they trust you, they trust that you will say, I'm going to both work with the partner that you select, and I'm going to spend all my time trying to oust your partner, right? I'm just going to do what's right for you. And those are both emotional things. How do you not get threatened by other world-class companies working for the same client? And how do you convince the client? So my today's one, in addition to those three of insight, ideas, and imagination, is how do you basically earn the client's trust to help take them into the future?
I think one of the challenges with that is that people are looking to, and by people I mean these other entities that are working on behalf of the agency or the marketer, are wanting to expand their suite of services and encroach in new areas that would no longer require them to, quote unquote, work with others, but rather say, let's just take more on our shoulders.
Right.
So how do you balance that to say, like, we want to expand our suite, but also we need to play nice in the sandbox?
The key is how does the client's business grow and win? And how do you define what you do in an area where it appears that it's a growth area versus a sort of red ocean? There was this whole idea of like blue ocean strategy, which is do not compete where there is a lot of blood, because it means the sharks are eating each other.
Yeah.
Go out, you know, into the sort of open ocean. One of the biggest challenges that we faced as a quote unquote, as defined as an advertising industry, is we have defined ourselves at some stage narrowly that our base business without question is in decline. If you think about the business as creating television commercials and placing them in media to disrupt people's viewing, to interact with them with messages, that business in the Western world, United States, United Kingdom, not necessarily all over the world, is in decline. Newspapers are down, magazines are down, radio is flattish. Okay, out of home is up about 2-3%. Video is up, but television viewing is down. But because television still remains one of the last mass media, its dollars still go up, but the actual inventory is down. So what people are doing is they're voting with their feet, eyeballs, and behavior away from advertising. There's no doubt about that. In the next 5 years, the ability to advertise to people will decline by 25-30%. So if you define yourself as you're in the business of creating and distributing advertising, then it's a red ocean and you want to expand your business into every kind of difference. If you're on the other hand, which is what we're trying to do as a firm and has been for the last 5 years, that we're helping our clients transform their marketing and their business, which is our broader businesses, those are very big growth areas. And that's where technology and strategy and creativity come together. And those are businesses that are, for instance, communication globally is $500 billion. The business I've just defined, where marketing, technology, and creative intersect. I'm not talking about those three separately, just the intersection. That's where, let's say, Accenture Interactive, Deloitte Digital, parts of McKinsey, us all interact. It's $1.6 trillion, which is three times the size of our business. So my thing is, if we start understanding that that's the business that we're looking at, and that there's a major growth area, then we behave differently.
So I want to build off of one of the last things that you said, that you're expecting that the advertising component is going to continue to dwindle down. And I know you gave some rationale for why, but isn't that just going to be a hard pill to swallow for a lot of people in the advertising business, especially people on the agency side? Do you think that that's going to be widely accepted?
My thing is this, there are some things that happen, and whether you accept it or not accept it, they happen. The future arrives, change happens, you either adapt to it or you become irrelevant. Whether you like it or not is irrelevant.
Sure.
The question simply is, if it's going to happen and you can't stop it, there's nothing that can stop what is going to happen to the future of marketing and advertising. What is driving it is a combination of us, which is people, and technology, and just, you know, demographic and other changes. The challenge is real. The challenge you've made is real. A big part of leadership is to convince people to do three different things. One is, leaders tend to insist on recognizing and describing reality. So one of the things I learned from a lot of my bosses was, you got to accept and recognize reality and then work from that reality, not like I refuse to accept it. The second is, you got to give and bring your organization along, that as they change to face that reality, there is a place for them and they are incentivized to do so. A lot of people say, change is good. And I always say, as I've often said, change is good. You change. I'm happy. I don't need to change. Look, I've stayed in the same company for 37 years. I don't want to change anything.
Yeah.
But what tends to basically happen is, change is important, but unless you can bring people along, like I changed because of a combination of, my management allowed me to grow while I was changing, and they incentivized me to grow while I was changing. If my management basically says, our company is going to change, but we are not going to incentivize you, train you, or bring you along, then I'm going to resist the change.
Sure.
The reason why in most companies, I'm not saying my company, but across the business world, and not including our clients and clients' competitors, we've not built a strong enough case to the people as to why they need to change. It just, change is good for the company and change is good for clients. My whole stuff is, but if it's not good for me, I don't care whether it's good for the company or clients. I mean, I'll say it's really good for the company and clients, but if it's not good for me, I don't understand why I'm going to change. And we forget that, right? So that's the other. So if one is facing reality, second is bring change. Third, and this is the hardest part, the people who most have to change are people now like myself. Because somewhere along, we may have gone by our sell-by date. We may have stopped learning how to learn. We may have not become, you know, let's put it this way. I grew up in a world where there was no personal computers, even when I joined the company. So there's no personal computer. So forget about crazy stuff like search and social media and digital. I today know how to use social media, and I know how to use computers, and I know how to use digital. Certain things like social media, many people of my age refuse to use it or leverage it or use a lot of different things. Like, I could give you a list of 20 podcasts I hear. A lot of my colleagues don't even know what they are. And my whole stuff is, okay, that means it's us is the problem. By the way, that is true also with our very senior clients. So I have the opportunity to go to our senior clients, and I just earlier this week did 2 board-level events with clients. And part of what I tell the board, and I still have my job and they haven't kicked me out yet, is, hey, people. First, I explain to them how I struggle to change, but I'm an old person. Then I say, look, you all are powerful people, and part of it is, you know, you may be the problem. And no one speaks to them like that. And by the way, you can get better. You can upgrade your operating system. My hardware can't change, but I can upgrade my mind. I can change my behavior. Those are the three key challenges. Accept reality, bring people along, and sometimes recognize that management themselves need to change. That's what we don't do. What we do is we talk about disruption, and we talk about ANA things, and we talk about someone not being this and not about that. We'll never face the real truth. And the truth basically is change is hard, reality sucks, and sometimes leadership's the problem.
I do think there is something to accepting reality being directly correlated with drawing meaningful insights. So I'm hoping we can talk about some insights that specifically relate to a major insight that you put out into the industry and have talked about extensively related to, I would say, really the more digital side of the advertising coin. So I know I can accept that overall advertising may be holistically on the decline, but I think there are areas of advertising that continue to grow and grow fiercely. So to lean into that more, and you can really detail this with more specificity, is the concept of the three connected eras.
Yes.
Do you want to walk us through those? Because that's going to be the basis of more conversation.
Yeah. So because I've been around for a bit, I have tried to frame the world. The original idea of the three, I call it the three connected eras. And what it was that it became clear to me that while online has been around for a long time, the internet's been around for a long time, and online outside of the internet, things like AOL, Prodigy, CompuServe were around in the 90s and late 80s and early 90s. It was really only in the mid to late 1990s when the World Wide Web came to be. Things really sort of changed. I began to call that the first connected age. So when the World Wide Web through the web browser started to take off. And at that stage, there were two forms of connection. You clicked on a blue link and you got somewhere. And the people who best directed to where you got was a company called Google. And then if you actually clicked on that and it wasn't information and you were trying to sell something, another company called Amazon sold books at that end. And two of the five most valuable companies in America were given birth in that era. And one basically said, I'm going to connect you to information. And the other said, I'm going to connect you to a transaction, which actually began with a book. In 2007 was the second connected era. And it builds on the first one. And that came around social, where we were connected to everybody, and mobile, where we were connected all the time. That happened around 2007, because that's when iPhone came out. And around that is when all these Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn clustered around. And now we were no longer just connected to a transaction or connected to information, but we were connected to everybody and connected all the time. 2007 to 2017 was the second era. It builds on the first era. And as a result of that, those two eras, you also had Apple, Facebook, Amazon, and Google as four of the five most valuable companies. At this stage, marketers, management, and businesses now say, okay, now we get it. So I said, if you align with the power of the era, you can build amazing wealth. You do not align with the power of the era, you destroy wealth. Magazines, newspapers, taxi medallions. If you sort of think about it, no major brand has been built in America using television since 2007. It's been used to scale brands, but build the brands. We think about Casper, Warby Parker, Dollar Shave Club, Uber, Airbnb. They were built through what? Mobile, social, search, commerce, sampling, word of mouth, and data. And so the whole idea is 10 years in, not surprisingly, major marketing and major companies all over the world are, oh my God, what the hell happened? I said, hey, it's been happening for 10 years. It didn't happen the day before yesterday. Which then says, hey, by the way, we're about to enter the third connected era. So if you were late on the first or the second, think about what's happening on the third. And at the third, we have four things going on. And they build on each other. So it's not that one doesn't work on the other. One is data connecting to data, which is the way I describe AI and machine learning. Things connecting to things, which is the Internet of Things. New ways of connecting, of which voice is the first one that has scaled, and maybe augmented reality will be the second one. New businesses will be born because of mobile, because of mapping on mobile, and because of social, so you could make recommendations and rate people, is why Airbnb and Uber came along. The ratings allowed to have basically a trust parameter. The mapping basically allowed you to find the Airbnb place and your car to find you. Mobile meant you had a computer on the move, which allowed you to do all of these things. So this interaction built exactly new businesses. So now we're going to build new businesses around there. And that era has already begun, and we're 2 years into it. To show you how powerful it is, in the United States, I've been told that 50% of all searches on the phone are now mobile. Sorry, a voice, right? So 50% of all, so it's either you basically say, you know, okay, Google, tell me something, right? Or Siri, or Alexa, tell me something, or whatever it is. So increasingly, we're moving into a world where all these things become very prevalent. So that's the third connected era.
Before we dive deeper into the third connected era, I'd like to take a step back into the first connected era to just talk about how you faced some of the challenges that might have come with the birth of what was new then in the 90s. So I was reading a little bit in your bio about you being the director and founder of the Interactive Marketing Group at Leo Burnett. And at that time, you had gone ahead and debuted a program that leveraged both CD-ROM and America Online for McDonald's and GM. So, in a time when really the internet was in its infancy, how were you getting adoption when there really weren't even that many people using it at that time?
So there were two reasons we did it. So in 1992, 93, I was working in our direct marketing group, and I began to understand that the direct marketing could be very powerful, but direct marketing had two physical problems. The first is you had to spend a lot of money finding the audience. You had to buy database lists. You had to buy magazine lists. But the second is you had to spend a fortune sending an interaction or message to them. You had to buy paper, kill trees, buy postage. If you were going to do variations besides their name, it was very expensive to do different types of packages to different people. It worked for, let's say, cigarettes or for an automobile. It didn't work for food, packaged goods, a lot of other people. And it was slow. But the real physical aspect was very hard to get the list and very hard to reach these people. And I began to realize there was an option, and the option was, and that's how I was using CompuServe and Prodigy, but then I discovered AOL. And relative to CompuServe and Prodigy, AOL was easier, a little bit more graphic. And at that time, it had 300,000 members. It grew up to be multiple tens of millions. I had the opportunity to, I was working that time on a McDonald's project, and they had gotten into interactive because they thought they were going to do an interactive full service test in Orlando, future of TV. I had gone down there and I'd come back and I told our McDonald's client that I don't believe the technology was there, it wasn't going to work. He had said, I'm your only client for your interactive marketing group, so what are you going to do? So I said, I think instead of learning about how to do interactive rich content on full service TV, which isn't happening, you should separate them and learn about rich content in one way and interaction in the other. And if and when they come together, you'll be prepared. So he says, what do you mean? I said, there's this thing called the CD-ROM, but more importantly, remember, I wasn't selling a technology, I was selling something. What I was saying is, you are trying to reach kids. Kids change really fast. There's this new thing called CD-ROMs that they're playing with. But there's a really interesting company called Broderbund that is creating amazing stories. And one of the first ones was called Arthur Teacher's Trouble. We should go listen and hear from them. The second is you have a direct marketing program that's working. We can port it over to online. So at that time, they had a program called McMoms, aimed for mothers. So I said, could we do that on online? And that's how we basically, it was like, take a program and see if we can make it more cost effective. Recognize that kids are changing. The CD-ROM might be a way to understand how kids' behaviors and interaction, and this may be also the future of toys. And at some stage, the economics may mean you can give this away as a Happy Meal toy. Let's go study that.
Yeah.
And that's how it began. And it was, even though it was early, it was, you can be a market leader, you can be an innovator, and it'll take you 2 or 3 years to figure out how to do it, at which stage this will scale. If it does not scale, because we didn't know it was going to scale, we could say we learned something. If it scaled, right, you have first mover advantage, which is incredible. What I find amazing is when someone says, this is a cool new technology, you should use it. It doesn't make any sense to just use a new cool technology if it doesn't fit into some part of your business. Now, in some cases, it might reinvent your business. Now, this I knew a few years later. Early on, I was just thinking of it as an extension of advertising. But as it grew, I began to realize that some of these things actually create completely new businesses.
Well, one thing to draw on from something you mentioned before, it's that there's oftentimes a reluctance to accept reality. So just knowing that at that time, it was still very early, but like a lot of these concepts in the 90s would seem wildly new age, maybe probably really hard to accept, especially if you're reporting to people who aren't actively using the internet themselves, especially when it was in its like 1.0 or 1.1. One stage. So how did you combat that?
So the way we did it was through people. We're speaking today here, and literally at 5 o'clock at Leo Burnett building, I will meet after 15 years maybe, one of the people who actually made this possible. But here's how we did it. The first is, remember when I launched the Leo Burnett Interactive Marketing Group, and then we merged that into a company and called it Giant Step. I had already spent over 12 to 13 years at the company. So I was very senior already. So I was basically someone who was relatively senior saying this is happening, which is different than someone with 3 years experience saying, I have come up with a new technology. Number two, I became friends with the people who were running the businesses and said, let me show you how this works and let me actually sample it and tell me if this makes sense. So this gentleman was running the entire Kellogg's business, which was huge, still is a huge client in those days. His name is Al Rail. And he basically said, educate me on this. And so I showed him how it works. And he said, this is something we need to take. So then he and I went to Kellogg's. And Kellogg said, okay, this Rashad guy, we kind of know a little bit. But Al, we trust. And Al is saying this is important. That's how we did it. So I actually brought the people who had the client's trust. I got them to help me sell it, even though it was in the early days. And Al, in fact, reminds me, he says, like, we did a lot because you and I worked together. And we sometimes forget it because the reason leadership at companies are reluctant to change is no one explains it to them. It's just given like, hey, this is the way it is. And I would also say, what are you interested in? Are you interested in phishing? So let's go on to AOL and see what's happening on phishing. Go and try to find if there was anything in phishing and CD-ROMs.
Yeah.
And I'd say, see this. So I would, this is interesting. So I said, if it's interesting for phishing, it could be interesting for your business. So that's how I would make that happen. So I never forgot the people.
You mentioned the words early mover advantage earlier on. And I do feel like when you're bringing forth insights like the one you just described, you kind of have to subscribe to that mentality in order for you to have an appreciation for that kind of change. So were you finding that a lot of clients under Leo and Starcom were subscribing to that ideology?
So what tends to happen is the nice thing about working with companies like Starcom and Leo, and what we were doing is we only needed two or three or four clients. We needed only a couple of clients to get started. And we could build a very interesting business with four or five. And between them, they had 50 or 60. So all I needed to do was find three or four friendlies inside my company, like an Al Rail and like other people, who would show me how to go make this thing happen. Once I had a couple and I could show some early indications of success and show what the work is, it was then something that other clients said, I want one of those, because I would then show it with to all my colleagues. And my colleagues would say, we should take some of this out to our client. But at that stage, it was no longer about early mover advantage. It was still early mover advantage. It was more about a peer envy, which is how come you're doing this? Because the early people, not only did we get good work, but the chief marketing officers, brand managers on those started becoming famous. Ad Age would write about them. Ad Week would write about them. It was like these were pioneering, doing new things, etc. So their peers are basically saying, what's this? At the same stage, while I was doing it, it wasn't really me because I was at the head of this whole thing. I started appearing in all these like Time Magazine, Business Week. So then my colleague said, like, he's an idiot. How come he's managed to do this? I got to do that too. And so that's how it worked out.
I'm sure that's not what they said. To that point, I want to move us into the second era, the second connected era, where two of the things that you mentioned that specifically were given birth to and really, come to fruition across that time period were both the smartphone and then social networks.
Yes.
So let's start off with smartphones. Here's a question I'll position to you. Do you feel that smartphones, especially from the standpoint of advertising, has reached its peak as far as what can be brought to the table? Because let me tell you why I'm asking you that question. I feel like a lot of mobile ads, and it's ironic hearing this from me because I've worked in a mobile specific capacity for most of my career. A lot of mobile ads are terrible.
Right.
They're really maybe the worst. So do you see there being a lot of room specifically from an advertising perspective, knowing that the majority of display dollars are spent on smartphones or mobile devices?
I've always basically believed that the mobile phone is a terrible place to do advertising on.
Okay.
And I've said it from like day one. I'm not saying we shouldn't do advertising, but it's a terrible place to do advertising.
Right.
The reason it's a terrible place to do advertising is, first of all, it's a personal device and you don't want ads to show up in a personal device, including if you're basically, let's say, looking at content. Advertising ends up costing you three ways. First, is in a small space, it clutters up what you're actually trying to read. Second, you are actually paying for it because you are paying for the bandwidth. And usually the bandwidth of the advertising hogs up much more data than the content that you're actually trying to do, till recently because of video. But in the old days, when you thought about it, you were reading print and the graphic images primarily came from the advertising. You are paying for it. So one is, I'm getting this thing that I really don't want. Second is, I'm actually paying for it, which is kind of like weird. And the third is, as it retargets, I feel really creepy because it's a personal device, but it's creeping around. Instead, I suggested to people, and I have been on record for a long time, that said it's a fantastic marketing device. It's not a great advertising device. And as a marketing, why don't you deliver a service or utility? My whole thing is, when you use a phone, you use it most of the time. When you're not using it to read something, you use it most of the time to get a service or express yourself. Using it for Instagram, social media, mapping. It's a utilitarian device. So why don't we actually add utilities to the utilitarian device versus advertise?
To that point, they say that there's been exponential growth in how much mobile video people are consuming. So
yes. So increasingly people are consuming mobile video. But if you think about it, they're not actually consuming ads on video. They're basically consuming YouTube, tiny shows. They're using stories and all the stuff that's on Snap and Instagram, etc. Oddly, which tends to basically happen is, even in that world, I believe there is a limitation that you can have with advertising. Because I think broadly, people are fed up of advertising. Okay, people are absolutely fed up of advertising that's not relevant and that intrudes. Scott Galloway, who is a professor at NYU, he has this line which says, advertising is a tax that poor people pay. So I spend, okay, a lot of money. How much is a lot of money? It is a lot of money. I spend $99 a month to avoid all advertising.
You do?
I do. I get YouTube Red. I get Hulu without ads. Obviously, I have HBO and I have Netflix. Everything that I read online, I read through what was Next Issue Media and now, which is Apple News. Most of these things have very little ad. And I basically have the premium or versions. I have the ad-free version of AMC. I have the ad-free version of FX. So in effect, I've gone out of my way to remove every ad wherever I can get it. I probably reduced my ad load by 95% and it cost me $99 a month. So someone basically said, that's a fortune, that's $1,200. And I said, yes, but you don't have to go over, like I've gone and done it. I can show you a $40 version of doing it because I've included HBO. I've included a lot of other things. I can show you a $40 version. So they said, well, not everybody has $40 a month. So I said, the people who you want to sell automobiles, new automobiles, computers, expensive vacations, they do. And if they don't have $40, they ain't going to buy no car. So in effect, most advertising now goes to people who are not well off, which is not surprising why most packaged goods marketers have to cut prices all the time, because the real differentiator is no longer the advertising, it's how low can your price be, because you're speaking to a price-sensitive person. And so my whole stuff is, don't incentivize me to sell you something you don't want. But what it then does is I would tell a client, take your money and build me a better product or service.
I think that's the dichotomy of both the ad revenue model versus the subscription model, right? Is that if people are not willing to pay for something, then that's where advertising becomes such a big piece of.
So I, for many, many years, when I was speaking to the folks in the magazine industry, the things I was basically told when I said these things, I was pushed back and said, well, advertising underwrites fine content. And I said, my clients actually don't want to underwrite fine content. They want to reach their customer. And if they can reach their customer without underwriting fine content, they will. Make no mistake, we are not underwriting fine content. Because while we're also underwriting fine content, we're underwriting massive valuations of companies that have got nothing to do with fine content. So in effect, what tended to basically happen is, if there's a way to reach people without it, it will happen. And I said, therefore, do not be reliant on advertising revenue. Try to differentiate and create subscription revenue, e-commerce revenue, event revenue, any revenue you want. Your advertising revenue is going to decline. One of the most successful companies in the recent 3-4 years has been the failing New York Times. So the failing New York Times is what Mr. Trump has called it, has almost tripled its stock price since he got elected. I think they're succeeding in great part because they were early and it took them a long, long time. And my friend Martin Nissenholz, who no one talks about, actually put them online. Martin Nissenholz, 15, 20 years ago, put them online. But if you think about everything that they do, one of their fastest growing aspects is a company called T-Studio. It's their in-house ad agency. They're a major driver of podcasts, a major driver of events. Their subscription revenue, they have over 1 million, I think, online subscribers. And now they've finally got to a place where their online growth is offsetting the decline in print, because the decline in print was taking place a lot. They have had to move to a model which has to be subscription plus other, you know, subscription services, etc. That is the reality. And so what is standing to happen is companies that don't understand that come into trouble. If you think about the Publicis Group, in 1995, 4% of our revenue was digital. The last time we measured, or the last time I saw, because we stopped measuring this as digital as the world became digital. But in 2017, 56% of our revenue was digital. Now, that was a revolution. We went from 5 to 56%. And it included changing stuff, buying stuff, including Performix and Digitas and Razorfish and LBI and Sapient. we began to realize with Sapien that we needed to get into business transformation and consulting. We didn't have those. So when Epsilon closes, we will have over 15,000 engineers in a company that had none 10 years ago. So what you've taken is we've recrafted an entire company. Our results yet don't show it. You know, we're growing minus plus 1%. Structurally, we've spent $8, $9 billion, changed the way we operate, made major investments, running as fast as we possibly can from basically being reliant on interruptive television advertising for packaged good marketers, because that is going nowhere. And it's been very expensive, and so far it's been very painful. But we could see this coming, and that happens to be the reality of what happens. Today, you know, when people basically say, well, you know, scale, etc. I always point out this example of Kylie Jenner. So Kylie Jenner created $1 billion worth of sales using a combination of Pure Beauty, which is a company that manufactures her stuff, her Instagram account with 120 million people, Shopify for e-commerce. And so when a big major marketer tells me, I got scale of manufacturing, scale of distribution, scale of everything, I say, take your scale and shove it. Doesn't matter. There's new scale, not just old scale. Old scale matters. There's new scale. What about the scale of talent? What about the scale of ideas? What about the scale of data? What about the scale of networks? Why aren't we talking about that? And so part of it is we as an industry, and this is not just us, but we broadly as an industry, which is everyone in the ecosystem, from companies like yourselves to us, to our clients, everybody, have to sort of recognize the world has changed. And by basically saying it's the same, or you're the problem and I'm the problem, is this doesn't make sense. Hey, there's a new world order. How do we get there? And once a client tripwires into, oh shit, I got to rethink my business, I got to rethink my marketing, that's a huge asset. Then we have to convince them that we're actually good at doing it, which we hopefully will do. It's a huge different area versus you are the people who basically do ads. Of course we do ads. Ads will still be important, but it's got to be more than that. That's what I'm basically sort of telling folks. It's not that the advertising business is going away, but it is declining, and that's where the fighting is. And when the fighting occurs, something very bad happens, which is people are forced to reduce prices. So I'll give you an example. When we were running Danu, when I went with my team to Danu and we sold stuff to our clients, we were basically selling it at 3 times the price that my agency was selling people. We were doing different work, so I wasn't charging 3 times for the same work. I was doing completely different work. But on an hour basis, my people were paid 3 times as much as everybody else. And the reason is what we were doing was rare. There was massive demand with limited supply. The other people were basically doing something that was not that rare. Okay demand, too much supply. This whole idea of navigating our businesses and navigating our future into the big, broad spaces which are growing is hard to do. And that's what I've basically been encouraging people to do. Because a lot of stuff that a lot of people are focusing on is silly stuff, like ad viewability. Yeah, it's important. But is that going to change your business? No. Let's get real. Who's going to help me in the future? How is my business relevant? How do I engage with people? Those are the real issues we should be talking about as an industry.
Leading into modern day, I want to focus on that third connected era and some of the things that I think you also briefly touched on earlier on, as far as AI, IoT, and voice being major components that have really come to the table in 2018 and will continue to be prevalent moving forward. So can you talk to me a little bit more in terms of how any one of those components is playing a role and how you're servicing clients today?
Let's start with something like voice. You know, increasingly it's going to become important. So voice is not like an addendum. Voice is the way people interact. So how do every one of our marketers think about marketing, including what is their voice? You know, MasterCard has recently launched, they're not our client, but MasterCard has basically launched its voice look. So how do you sound when you don't, no one can see you? You know, people had like symbols and logos and stuff like that. How do you sound? The key thing with voice is people don't want to say, hey, Alexa, play me an ad. They want a utility or service. So what utilities and services can you actually engage with? How do you deliver those utilities and services? So voice is a key component. There's some capabilities, but voice should be, there shouldn't be like a voice group. One of the things that began to happen and the big struggle is I remind people that all these new things from voice to recommendation engines to understand algorithms and recommendation engine is the future of marketing. And if you don't think about it, a lot of companies will get into the same problem, which is one of the reasons why some of the quote unquote traditional creative shops ran into trouble is not because they don't have very smart people. It's primarily because they got separated from the tools of the trade. A good creative has always been basically working with technology. They worked with radio, they worked with Adobe Photoshop, they worked with a whole bunch of other stuff. At some particular stage, this digital thing was something like special. But they were already working on digital on computers. And so once they began to lose an interaction with how search worked, how display worked, how online worked, how video worked, then what began to happen is they didn't craft ideas that way. They basically started crafting ideas only for television or for print. So the first thing that we basically say is recognize that voice is already very prevalent. Recognize that algorithms basically work in some particular form. Think about the Internet of Things not necessarily as the little Amazon button which they've discontinued that you could go and push for your Tide or something like that. Think of it as much more broader. Think of it that when a car is ordered by your phone, it's actually an Internet of Things. So think of a world where every device is either an enabler or a listener or a participant. Also think about what would happen when there is a world where you don't require to sign up for broadband because your phone, 5G, allows you to do that. And a key thing with 5G is not only the speed, but the lack of latency, which means there's no drop-off. It's very rapid. But that sort of re-explores. So start thinking about how that will change your business. Now, many of these are initially less on the creative end of it and more of it in the business strategy and marketing support end of it. The thing is, we should be able to go to our clients and work with them to anticipate. The biggest challenge has never been the technology. The biggest challenge has been, and that's one of the things you know, I have in my book, is while the future is without doubt digital, data-driven, and silicon, human beings are analog, carbon-based feeling. Analog, carbon-based feeling people take some time to change. And so the key is, if you want something to happen at any scale 3 years from now, you have to start now because it'll be too late to run an animatic in the Super Bowl. You want to run an animatic in the early days when nobody knows that you're learning.
Knowing that there are going to be some businesses out there that ultimately still are going to probably lean into these connected eras, whether it be the primarily second or third connected era, which we're, I think, we're waxing and waning across both of them, they're still going to be leaning into some more traditional medium or formats from a programmatic advertising standpoint.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, do you see the utilization or the ubiquity of use for some of these new connected devices really taking effect on the way that advertisers are positioning ads in the economy?
Yes. So I suggest to all advertisers to stop thinking about words like programmatic and digital. I think they have to think about how do we effectively deliver interactions across channels. Programmatic eventually did major damage to the industry. And you know what it did? It saved costs and it destroyed industries.
Well, I do think there are different types of clients that are approaching advertising. And there are some that are in that top tier where they can get that really full service, where you're really looking at how can we build our business. So the scope of work is far grander than maybe somebody who's being serviced at a mid-level tier. So that's where I think leaning on things like programmatic and other types of display buys.
So we have a big programmatic business, everybody else. But here's the thing. If there is a cost that technology can remove, it should. Everything I do is far away from a machine. I go out of my way to do stuff that no machine can do.
Like what?
Like thinking like I currently think. Tell me how a machine like this can do it.
Yeah.
Inspiring people, talking at boards. And when you can, I'll run in another direction far away from. So whenever machines catch up, I'll run. Machines can basically do stuff that people can do. And so having lots of people at an agency working Excel spreadsheets, which a machine can do, I said, let the machine do. You're absolutely right. So that is one part of it. But what tends to happen is what marketers have made a mistake of thinking is that's the only thing that eventually will work. So now what basically happens is you have to specialize. What's one of the fastest growing things right now is podcasts. Still a big, small business, but it'll be a $1 billion business soon. And yes, you can do programmatic delivery, but a programmatic ad in a podcast will not work because it has to basically, the best ads are delivered by the person who's actually running the podcast. So if you were running an ad, you'd have to run the ad because an ad that sounded like a Bugs Bunny voice coming in wouldn't work. Okay? And so the whole world is working against programmatic and some people are saying, oh, it's all about programmatic. And I'm saying everybody's working against it because it's no economic interest. Yes, it's the cost-effective interest. So the process part, the supply chain gets more efficient. But if on the other end, the marketing doesn't get more efficient or more effective, how much can you put in it? So anything that should be programmatic is programmatic. Where is out-of-home going? After all, the out-of-home people, don't you dare become completely programmatic. You lose control of your inventory, and now they know it, right? The podcast people aren't doing that. When you're doing omnichannel experiences, that doesn't basically work. Part of the programmatic stuff is the entire industry started focusing on the plumbing, forgetting about the poetry. You differentiate brands on poetry. You don't differentiate brands on plumbing. You don't select a house on whether the plumbing works. It's a given that the plumbing works. You do it on landscape and design and, you know, things like that. And somewhere along, once marketers understand that technology can be good, but they need to understand it in detail from a business perspective and not just as a cost savings perspective, then whatever they do makes sense. But it's people haven't educated them on the pluses and minuses. The thing to tell clients is, hey, the brands that are winning are utilizing these platforms by differentiating with an idea. What do you think Amazon is doing? Drones, buying Whole Foods, trying to buy other people.
Yeah.
How do you programmatic that part of it? You don't. That's what my thing is. If you think broader, you have a very different argument. And what I'm asking our industry to do is, how about thinking once in a while?
Something that you drew on a little bit earlier was not just executing from an advertising perspective, but having a very sure sense of what you're doing from a marketing perspective and having that balance between the poetry and the plumbing. I mean, I know sitting on this side of the aisle, there's many pieces of the business that are obsessively focused on programmatic and just the execution of digital display. So with knowing that, I mean, people are completely blind to that side of the business. In fact, you can go and talk to people at agencies or at digital specific organizations, and there is no cognizance of what's taking place from a marketing perspective. So what do you say to those folks?
Let's talk about something. I did a podcast at AdExchanger. I spoke at AdExchanger. It's all this year. So I spoke at AdExchanger in January. I did a podcast last month. At their major conference, I basically talked about how do you optimize for the citizen and not the consumer. And I basically explained why algorithmic stuff was going to take everybody to nowhere but destruction. So the idea with the citizen and a consumer, I talked about first, second, third connected ages. I talked about how much wealth it had created and how all the people in the room could be proud of what we've done. Because I do believe that all these technologies, and not just the ad part of the technologies, but what ad has funded some of these technologies, has made the world better. I do believe that Facebook, Twitter, Google, Instagram, Apple, I much more want a world with them than without them. We have new challenges, that's different. But what I did say is the downside of some of these technologies also existed, and we needed to start addressing them before it would take us over. And the three issues were basically the lack of trust, both in the ad ecosystem, ad agencies, but over more broadly, which is, can I trust even the church? Can I trust the University of Southern California? Trust. The second one was the rising inequality, which is very significant. And the third one is closed-mindedness, because these algorithms, right, are, as someone basically said, I forget the lady, I've quoted her before, are weapons of mass destruction.
It's funny.
Okay. And the whole idea of the filter bubble, etc., we've created these things. This algorithmic thing has created some of the very same problems that we have. And these are going to now tarnish our clients' brands, tarnish our clients' reputation, eliminate strategic choices. If a client says, I can only advertise in Google and Facebook and nothing else works, I said, then you might as well give up your whole company to Google and Facebook and go home. What are you working for? And you have data and privacy risk, which is who's using whose data to create these new DTC brands. That automatically made people think completely differently. And then, of course, I said, here's how you should think about it, and, you know, think higher, feel deeper, or think the opposite, etc. I had some personal things to think about. But that really, really resonated with the audience because they were all worried about. The issue simply is you cannot have an industry where only two or three companies win everything. That's not an industry, okay? That's bullshit. I've always believed in some sort of balance of power versus a place where marketers don't actually even control their budgets as much because they don't have as much data, they don't have as much access, they don't have ownership. Now, unfortunately, in the last 6-7 months, I've been more right than wrong. So now the FTC is coming running to try to break things up. It's very questionable. And the other thing I always have a problem with is that three people control the future of our industry. Sergey Brin, Larry Page, and Mark Zuckerberg, who between the three of them are the dominant shareholders of the two major platforms. And no one can say that they're wrong. Problem. I'm giving all my clients money to three people who can decide whatever they want to do. Problem.
I want to touch on one thing you said. Actually, you said two things I want to touch on about there being, let's say, evil in the industry.
Not evil in the industry. This whole idea of like we're holier than thou and Pollyannish, while worse by being able to stop stuff but refusing to and thinking the rest of the world is stupid is what I consider silly, because I might be stupid, but don't call my clients stupid.
But to that point, I think oftentimes there's an obsession over the next board meeting, making sure that you're hitting these revenue targets based on forecasts. So people are very tied to that. I think looking into some grander, bigger picture is oftentimes seen as a lofty goal made for people who have wildly big investment that they can put
forward. So this is where I disagree. The reason I disagree is I think where we have failed as an industry is we have not gone to the boardroom and explained to them how the models work.
Do you think people are too afraid to make those statements?
I don't know whether they're too afraid. But what happens is when I now go to the boardroom and I explain to them how it works, they do not start kicking me out, laughing hysterically, and basically saying you're an idiot, which they're perfectly capable of saying. Their basic stuff is, you're basically telling me that my entire business is at risk. I said, yes. And I said, I don't care how an advertising campaign does. I'm not here to talk to you about an advertising campaign. You could be optimizing an advertising campaign while destroying your business at the same time. And I said, if all your advertising campaigns are doing so well, how come your business isn't growing? And so my whole basic belief is, as a board, are you responsible for the quarterly numbers or as for the guidance of this company over the next 3 to 5 years? I just ask you as a board. I understand what a CMO may have to do, but even a CMO needs to do broader than that. Yes, when I was a media buyer, planner, media supervisor, account director, of course I have to do that. I'm not talking to those people. I'm basically now talking to the very senior people in companies. And I'm saying your job is to maximize your shareholder value. And what is starting to basically happen is they're beginning to recognize that something is up. They're putting a lot of pressure now for the first time. It's not that they haven't put pressure, but I know that there's massive increased pressure on the platforms. Everybody might be blowing kisses at each other, but I know behind there's now increased pressure as to what is this? I'm basically, in the end, I like marketing. I'm a marketing person. I might be a strategy or whatever, but it eventually comes about marketing and people and insights and ideas. And there was a line that I read, and I got into the marketing business with a line which says, from Philip Kotler, Northwestern, marketing is understanding and meeting customer requirements. And I always believed that as people got more powerful, in many years I said people have godlike power with the modern technology, that marketing would become so important that it would become as important as finance and logistics and everything else. And I said, at some stage, marketing will make it into the boardroom. So often, you know, when companies say we talk about the consumer, but then you look at who's there, you basically have finance. Yes, it's important to have money there. Technology, yes, it's important. Lawyers, yes, you know, chief legal officers on the board. You never see a CMO on a board. You never see a major marketer on a board. Not never, almost never. And these companies are talking about, we are consumer-led, we are this. Where? Well, who? How? Why? Where did that happen? So I said, we will make it to the boardroom because of this. But guess what I've discovered? We are now going to make it to the boardroom because somewhere along, someone didn't inform the board as to exactly what was going on. And now the boards are starting to pay attention to the fact that they may have lost some control over their future.
Do you think that, like you mentioned earlier on about needing to serve your clients or serve them better than you have in the past if you're on a board, that, you know, boards are willing to accept if there is financial compromise, it's worth taking the risk because they're going to be able to make up the difference through radical change within 3 to 5 years?
Here's what I would say is there are many examples of companies that have taken short-term hits for long-term gain. You know, people will talk about like Amazon didn't make money for years and years and look at all of that. But you don't have to go all the way there. You can take successful companies that took short-term hits for long-term gains. In the world of technology and software, one that we're very familiar with is a company called Adobe. So Adobe basically recognized that the world was going to the cloud. They were selling shrink wrap software. They decided to go to the cloud. As part of going to the cloud, their revenue declined significantly. Their stock price plummeted. And it plummeted into the low 20s, 30s from something much higher. Today, it's about $275, 2, 3, 4 years later, and it's considered a renaissance. They bought companies that, they were Adobe and Photoshop, and they bought companies like Omniture, and they bought, you know, Marketo and Magento, and they reinvented their company and are considered amazing. Domino's Pizza basically said, we have a sucky product. We have to improve our product. They did that, which was brave. And then they said, you know, are we really just a pizza business or in the pizza delivery business? So let's make pizza delivery and logistics amazing. And so they used all the modern technology and they invested. And by the way, their stock price has done better than any company but Netflix over the last 10 years. If a board can explain to the marketplace that they are going to be fine in 2-3 years, but they have to do this now, otherwise they're going to go nowhere. And at the very same stage, I can show lots of companies who did not make the hard decisions and they went out of business. And we are at a time when there is a strategic, and this is the reason why boards are paying attention. This is not about advertising, right? This is not about advertising programmatic and how data is used. This is fundamentally, can you reinvent your business model for a modern world, or will you not reinvent your business model in the modern world? But my stuff to our clients is that's what we need to focus on. And why that eventually then helps everything, then including advertising and programmatic and all of those which are very important and growing, if it's done in the context of taking the business into the future versus optimizing a campaign is different. Regardless of how young the people are in my company, when I was working and running companies, we used to do all hands before all hands people knew what all hands were, right? After having some fun and jokes and people justifying their existence, one of our leaders, and sometimes me, would basically talk about where we were going and why we were going where we were going. And this was down to the person who was a trainee. And people said, why is that important? I said, if you're working on a piece of stone, you're not working on a piece of stone. I want you to see what the cathedral looks like. Because if you know what the cathedral looks like, then you'll work on a stone differently. I think as an industry, we have lost sight of the cathedral that we're working at. And the cathedral basically became optimizing a return, optimizing a campaign, reducing a cost. That's not the optimization and the future of marketing. If that's there, I want to shoot myself and not be in the industry.
I agree with you. And I think it's unfortunately a mistake that's happening so rampantly because there's oftentimes a clog in the funnel and information isn't trickling down from the very top.
Right. And that's part of why one of the big things that I am writing about and talking a lot about is the future of leadership. And that's what we as an industry are struggling with. And I'm trying to explain to people that all of us can be good leaders. We can also be bad leaders. Let's all try to be good leaders versus be bad leaders.
Let's go ahead and wrap up our conversation on talking about just a couple of things related to career advice, because I think for some folks, some of the things you're going to bring to the table as far as the way that you might be approaching their areas of the business will be shocking, right? Especially if they might feel that, oh, this sounds like a threat to what I do. What are things that people who, whatever area of their career they're in related to advertising, what should they have a cognizance of as they build a future for themselves?
The first thing that they should do is recognize that most people are going to work in business for between 35 to 50 years. So try to make your career plans 3 to 4 years at a time and not 3 months to 4 months at a time, which is be patient. You know, people say, well, that's old fashioned. No, but be patient. Because sometimes if you keep switching jobs every couple of years or get all worked up about what happened for 2-3 months, you won't get anywhere. Now, obviously, I've been unemployable and stayed in the same place for 37 years, but I actually reinvented my career many times inside my own company. The second one is build a personal brand, because we're living increasingly in a world which is going to be networked and connected. Whether we know it or not, all of us are Uber drivers. Some of us are just paid more. Because what's going to happen is we're going to work. If you do, you also see this in like consulting companies or Hollywood models. People come together over a project. The project might be 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. It may not be a drive. But eventually, people will attract other people based on their niche, which is how good you are at doing something, your voice, do I want to follow you or not, and your story, whether I believe you or not. The third thing I would basically say to you, to young people, is please recognize that regardless of how young you are, try to help as many people as you can, because along the way, you're going to need other people's help. And what we'll figure out eventually is people will hire and fire people on how they treat other people or how they treated other people, as much as whether they're good at what they do or not good at what they do. And we are underestimating how important the soft skills are. And I think I was lucky that I had amazing people working with me, because they learned something and I learned something from them. But even more important, wherever they are, I would say almost everybody, I mean, I think everybody, but probably almost everybody, would still take a meeting with me and would help me 10, 15 years after they worked with me. You know, we forget that we will always remember the people who helped us when we needed help and who did the extraordinary. And we make it too transactional, which is why people say you do so much stuff and you help stuff for free. I said, no, I'm building my brand. I one day I'm going to need someone's help, right? I'll give them this very expensive price and say, now in your case, it's free. Now, if it's a very big company, I'll say, no, it's not free. But most people, it is. That's a third thing, which is you have to build a goodwill. And the goodwill isn't necessarily just looking cool on Instagram. It's much more than that. And the fourth one is spend at least 1 hour learning something new every day. And that is what has allowed me to stay relevant. It isn't like this is nothing about whether you're smart or not, right? It's question basically is, do you figure out some stuff? Do you actually do it every day? Do you figure out what is the right thing for you to do that you're good at? And then that becomes what you become good at.
You mentioned earlier on that you will make observations. I think that that is, interestingly enough, at odds with what a lot of people do, which is that they'll regurgitate things that are already being said in the industry.
Right.
And I don't even know how much conviction they have behind those thoughts. So I'm going to go ahead and assume that you're not in support of those kinds of behaviors. But as far as people coming up with original thinking, what would you suggest people do so that they can build a better brand for themselves?
The key to building a better brand for themselves is have a point of view, which is a lot of people give me facts, but they don't give me a point of view. Okay, if I could read those facts, what do you think? I want to know what you think. I don't know if it's right or wrong, but can you tell me what you think? I could read exactly the same facts as you just told me the facts, but what do you think? What's your point of view? The second is give me a sense of perspective, which is how do these facts fit with facts that came before or after? So in first era, second era, third era, is I'm giving people a sense of perspective. We should optimize on the citizen or not the consumer is a point of view. Don't put too much money and don't think programmatic is going to come and save your stuff is a provocation, which is the third thing. So my stuff is give people a point of view, give people a perspective, provoke people to think differently.
Well, I think if there's something you really specialize in, it is finding truth in subjective spaces. And we really appreciate you taking so much time out to come and chat with us.
Well, thank you. This was fantastic.
Yeah.
Hopefully it was helpful.
So that was our episode on innovation and advertising with Chief Growth Officer of Publicis Group, Rashad Tabakawala. Careers like Rashad's are what attracted me to advertising, and they also remind me of the type of work ethic and deep thinking people need to do to thrive in this industry. And to share a personal side note, when I felt that I wasn't able to ask all the questions I was curious about during our interview, Rashad was proactive in setting up a follow-up meeting. He's a guy who sincerely practices what he preaches. If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more from Rashad, you can. He's releasing his first book, Restoring the Soul of Business, Staying Human in the Age of Data, available for pre-order now on Amazon. That's it for this episode. I'm your host, Noor Nasir. We'll catch you next time for more at Tech Unfiltered.